The transfer from El Pescado's account to the charter outfit gave that game away. As for that tip to the DEA, it may not have come from you, but as far as the cops are concerned, it had your name on it. Graciela hung up then, because with those few words, she knew her life was over. Not just life as she knew it, but life itself. If she had access to her money and her fake IDs right then, she might make a run for it and be able to go into hiding. But even then, Felix would most likely find her. In jail or out, he would hire someone to track her down and kill her, just as he had hunted down each of her mother's attackers. Graciela wanted to howl and scream and bay at the moon, but she didn't.
"We need to turn around," she said.
"We're not going to Cottonwood?"
the driver asked.
"No, take me back to Phoenix."
"Where in Phoenix?"
"I don't know. To a hotel, I guess. Drop me off at a nice hotel."
Which is how Graciela Miramar ended up spending the last night of her life at the Arizona Biltmore. It was almost 3 o'clock in the morning when she finally checked in. There was a single parking attendant waiting by the driveway when she stepped out of the Escalade. The lobby was completely empty of customers. The lone clerk would later recall Ms. Miramar as being very subdued in her dealings with him, although he certainly remembered her paying for her room in cash out of an impressive roll of bills.
"Will you be needing assistance with your luggage?"
he asked after handing her a map and providing instructions for locating her casita.
"No, thank you," she said. "I can manage." "Is there a minibar in the room?"
"Of course, madam. A fully stocked minibar. We also have 24-hour room service."
Her casita was at the far back of the property. From the time she left the lobby until she reached her door, she walked the ramped and well-lit walkways without seeing another soul, and that was just as well. She had always been alone, even during the years when she had lived with her mother, and she would be alone now, too. Graciela understood how the cartels handled snitches. She would do this on her own terms, calmly, carefully, and deliberately. Once in the room, she didn't bother undressing, nor did she call for room service. She raided the minibar instead, opening the bottle of Merlot and dining on packages of potato chips, cheddar-flavored popcorn, and peanut M&Ms. She didn't turn on the television set. One of the 24-hour news outlets might have told her more about El Pescado's arrest, but she already knew as much about that as she needed to know. There was no sense in learning more. Instead, she sat there drinking her wine, snacking, and thinking about Frigg. It was revolting to have been done in by a damn machine. Owen had told her the AI was smart, but Graciela had gravely underestimated her opponent, and now she was done. She thought about writing a suicide note, but decided against it. The less said, the better. Let the cops puzzle it out. Either way, they would put it all together, or they would not. It was none of her concern. She finished the first bottle of wine and opened a second one. Cabernet, this time. By then she was slightly drunk, but not as drunk as her mother had been on her last night. And for some reason, that made Graciela giggle. She poured herself a fresh glass and set it on the coffee table while she unsealed the envelope and opened the two packets of fentanyl. She placed the patches on the backs of her hands and then sat there sipping from that final glass and watching as the poison gradually seeped into her system. When the opioid overdose finally did its work, the half-empty glass fell from her lifeless limbs and shattered on the tile floor. Later that day, just at noon, a housekeeper knocked on the door. When no one answered, the maid used her passkey to enter. She was the one who discovered the body, slumped over, but still sitting mostly upright on the sofa. And the only sign of violence in the room? That single broken glass. Chapter 65. On that Wednesday morning, the High Noon campus in Cottonwood was truly an armed compound. Stu had let everyone know about the situation with Graciela and the possibility that she might show up to cause trouble, so they all came to work carrying their various concealed weapons. They spent the better part of an hour in the break room gathered around the TV set and channel surfing through various local newscasts where El Pescado's arrest was the top story of the day. Naturally, DEA Special Agent in Charge, Robert McKay, and his arrest team were being cast as the heroes of the piece, but the people in Cottonwood all understood that for the second time in his life, Stuart Ramey was the man of the hour. Stuart and an AI named Frigg. When a call from Boise, Idaho showed up on Cammie's caller ID, she switched the phone onto speaker before she answered.
"Have you heard what's happened?" Tracy Cantrell demanded breathlessly. "That Duarte guy, the one from the sketch, has been arrested."
"We heard," Cammie said. "We were just sitting here in the office discussing that very thing."
"What should I do about it?"
"If I were you, I'd contact the DEA agent in charge down in Phoenix and have him get in touch with the cold case folks back in Chicago."
"But will the guy in Phoenix even talk to me?" Tracy asked.
"I'm not sure if you'll reach him directly, but someone at the DEA office in Phoenix will be more than happy to talk to you. And later today I'm planning on circling back to the five other families whose sons were involved in that mess in Panama. Maybe you're not the only one who remembers El Pescado's pug-ugly face from back then."
Once the phone call ended, they moved on to other things.
"Tell us about this Thor Foundation," Allie urged Stu.
"As far as I can tell, it's a shell organization, supposedly a philanthropic one, established in the Cayman Islands where Owen Hansen was planning on hiding his money. It only had a little over $200,000 in it before Frigg dumped all the Duarte cartel's cash into it overnight. Amazingly enough, when Frigg was putting Owen out of business, she added my name as a member of the board of directors."
"Will Mexico try to claim that money?"
"I don't know," Stuart said. "If they do, they can have it. If not..."
"You'll be running an NGO," Cammie said.
"Not me," Stuart told her. "No way."
"What about Frigg?"
B asked. "You mean, am I going to shut her down for good?
It seems to me as though in the past few days, she's more than proven her worth," B said.
"Yes, you're going to have to fine-tune her to get rid of all those problematic elements that could send us to jail. But if the cartel money ends up sticking and the NGO becomes a multi-billion dollar enterprise, maybe you could put her in charge of running it."
"From where?" Stuart asked.
"From right where she is," B said with a grin. "Down in the man cave."
"Maybe somebody on the board of directors of Thor Foundation would approve the purchase of a mostly vacant house in the village of Oak Creek to serve as the Foundation's headquarters. We'd make you a sweet deal."
"I don't even want to think about this right now," Stuart said. "It's too much."
Clearly, a few vestiges of Stuart 1.0 still lingered.
The break room meeting ended soon after that. Just after noon, a building inspector appeared at the reception counter. Shirley didn't let him set foot behind the entryway until she had called Abby Henderson over in Prescott and verified that this building inspector, Gary Reese, was the real deal. He was. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, with Stuart seated at his workstation running routine scans, Frigg sent him a flash briefing summons over the Bluetooth.
"What is it?"
"Breaking news out of Phoenix. The DEA is reporting that Graciela Miramar, thought to be Felix Duarte's daughter and the source of the tip that led to his arrest, has been found dead in a Phoenix-area hotel room where she is suspected of having committed suicide."
"What good news!" Stuart exclaimed. "Couldn't be better."
"And good for our team?" Frigg inquired.
"Definitely," Stuart said. "I think it counts as a home run."
"Home run," Frigg repeated. "In baseball, a hit that allows a batter to make a complete circuit of the bases, an unqualified success." "Yes, Stuart.
I believe Ms. Miramar's death is a home run.
It was late that night, just as blanket-swaddled Stuart was about to drift off to sleep on his chaise, when he remembered he had never asked for Frigg's report on the opera.
"Frigg," he said, "did you have a chance to study Thais?"
"Yes, I did," Frigg replied. "It is not what I would consider to be a happy story. Thais and Antonelle would have been better off if they had been on the same team."
"Yes," Stuart said. "That's it exactly. Good night, Frigg."
"Good night, Stuart. Sleep well."
Chapter 66. It was a busy month at High Noon Enterprises. The work got done, but there was plenty going on that had nothing to do with cybersecurity, and everything to do with the takedown of the Duarte cartel. There were a number of interviews with law enforcement, with DEA agent Ken Logan being the first to arrive wanting to speak to Stuart.
"A burner cell phone was found in Ms. Miramar's hotel room," he explained. "And the only call made from that phone was to you. How are you tied into all this?"
"One of her clients, Owen Hansen, left money to me when he died. The contact I had with her mostly concerned that."
"Then what about Tracy Cantrell?" Logan asked. "How is it that you people here are the ones who hooked Felix Duarte up with those homicides from the 90s?
After the Ron Webster firebombing, once we learned about the nexus between MS-13 and the Duarte cartel, Cammy Lee, my assistant, started doing some online research. She's the one who made the connection between that old composite sketch and Felix Duarte."
Logan didn't ask to see Cammy's browsing history, and neither did anyone else, but Stuart was glad it was still there. Everyone knew that if there had been some kind of shootout with Graciela at the business park in Cottonwood, those interviews might have been far more serious. As it was, Stuart was able to keep Frigg's very existence, as well as her contributions to the process, totally off the radar. Stuart spent hours dealing with Hank Cooper, B, and Allie's CPA, who sorted out the amount of taxes due on Stuart Ramey's various windfalls. Concerned about the wild volatility of the Bitcoin market, Stuart chose to convert most of his Bitcoin account into dollars so he could use it to pay the applicable taxes. And then he went car shopping. Using cash from the still-ongoing Bitcoin mining operation, he bought a brand-new four-wheel drive Dodge Ram crew cab pickup truck. Cammy, who had been lobbying for him to get a Prius, wasn't happy with that choice, but he was. 2 days before Thanksgiving, Stuart requested the weekend off.
"Are you going somewhere?" Allie asked.
"To Santa Barbara," he replied. "To see Irene Hansen. I have a check for her, and I want to deliver it in person."
On Thanksgiving Day, instead of accepting any of the three separate holiday invitations he'd received, Stuart Ramey set off on his first ever solo road trip. The last items he loaded into the crew cab were three small white crosses. The bottom of each cross was formed into a sharp point. He also brought along a sledgehammer. When he reached the exit to Vicksburg Road, he turned off I-10 and parked on the shoulder of the side road. Then, carrying the crosses and the sledgehammer, he walked to milepost 45. As he pounded the three crosses into the rock-hard dirt along the shoulder, Stuart's eyes blurred with tears. It was 38 years late, but at least he was getting the job done. Back in the truck, he headed west again, with Frigg's voice speaking in his ear, acting as co-pilot.
"Frigg," he said, "I would like to listen to the opera Thais. Would you like me to purchase and download a copy of the performance from the Metropolitan Opera?"
"Yes, please," he said, wondering as he did so if the recorded performance was the one Cammy had attended with her mother years earlier.
Stuart had never before listened to an opera all the way through. He didn't understand the words, but he knew enough about the story to be moved by the singing
The soprano in the role of Thais was amazing. Holiday traffic going into L.A. was exceptionally light. He checked into the same hotel in Burbank where he and Cammy had stayed a month earlier. On Friday morning, he headed off to Santa Barbara. He had called ahead. Irene Hansen was expecting him, and when he arrived at the house on Via Vistosa at 10 a.m., she was dressed to the nines when she opened the door.
"Why, Mr. Ramey," she said, "how very nice to see you again. Won't you come in? Would you care for something to eat, coffee or tea?"
"No, I'm fine," he said. "I won't stay long. It's just that I've done a lot of thinking about something you said when I was here before, that your son blamed you for your husband's suicide."
Irene nodded.
"That was always the case." "Were you aware that your husband was ill?"
"Harold ill?"
She seemed dismayed at the very idea.
"What are you talking about?"
"In going through your son's computers, I came across some medical records from a Dr. Richards."
"That would be Darryl Richards," Irene said. "He was Harold's physician for years and also his golf partner."
"It turns out your husband had been diagnosed with ALS.
ALS?
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease."
"Harold was sick? I don't believe it."
"He was more than just sick," Stuart said. "He was dying. I would guess he committed suicide in order to spare both you and your son, and maybe even himself, from the ordeal that was coming."
"Oh, my," Irene whispered. "He never said a word to me about it."
She cried for a time after that, and Stuart let her. When she finally dried her eyes, he reached into his pocket and pulled out the cashier's check he'd had the bank make out in her name. Even with the taxes taken out, it was still a very large amount.
"This is what your son left me," Stuart said, handing it over. "I believe that was an error on his part, and this money should have gone to you."
She studied the check for some time, then she looked at Stuart and smiled.
"You have given me something my son never did. Peace of mind. Your having the money was never an error."
With that, she tore the check into tiny pieces and dropped the shreds of paper into a crystal ashtray on the side table next to her.
"You're sure you don't want it?" Stuart asked.
"I have everything I need," Irene said. "I don't require anything more."
"Did your son ever speak to you about the Thor Foundation?"
"He never mentioned anything like that. What is it?"
"It's a philanthropic organization he started shortly before he died. I've been asked to look into keeping it going. Perhaps I'll donate some of this money to that."
"The money is yours, Mr. Ramey," Irene said. "You do with it as you see fit."
"All right," he said. "I will. As for the foundation, I'm thinking about changing the name from Thor Foundation to the Thais Foundation."
Irene Hansen clapped her hands in apparent delight.
"After Massenet's opera?" she asked. "That one has always been one of my favorites."
Duel to the Death, an Allie Reynolds novel, was written by J.A. Jantz and read by Karen Ziemba. It was recorded by Abita Austin at Simon & Schuster and by Michelle Medias and Demetrio Albano at Beat Street Productions. Editing and post-production by Glynn Corporated. Duel to the Death, an Allie Reynolds novel, was produced and directed by Erica Weintraub. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Duel to the Death, an Allie Reynolds novel, is available in hardcover from Touchstone. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio and part of the Allie Reynolds series, Man Overboard, Clawback, No Honor Amongst Thieves, and Cold Betrayal, all written by J.A. Jantz and read by Karen Ziemba.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.